Two things to begin with, and the first is simply to say a word of very warm thanks not only to all of you for attending, but to the Dean and Chapter of the Abbey for their kind invitation to be here during this week. The second preliminary remark is that I have, of course, given this series the title Questions of Faith. The faith about which I shall mostly be speaking is, you won't be surprised to hear, my own, which is Christianity. But I hope that there will be in the discussion some matters which are no less relevant to other faiths and their relationship to the 21st century, its culture, and its problems. A number of scientists, and a quite large number of non-scientists, regard science itself as an agent of wholesale secularization. That is to say, they see science as demystifying the world, opening up the world to rational questioning whose conclusions are not decided by authorities like archbishops. It is part of what some have called the disenchanting of the world. It is a process which makes the world more amenable to our control, more amenable to what we as human beings decide we would like to see happen. And because of that rather widespread view of science, there are two opposite, passionate attitudes towards it. It's regarded as both Messiah and Antichrist. If science really is something which promises to give us a heightened degree of control over our environment, surely it is something which promises us liberty such as we've never known before. And if that's what it promises, it's not surprising that some people do see it in messianic terms. At the same time, the uncontrollable forces that seem to be unleashed by scientific research and the unmanageable questions that arise make it something of which many people are profoundly afraid. And at the extreme, they will regard it as a toxic element in our human composition at the moment, dangerous to ourselves and our environment, dangerous to stable, assuring faith. And that's perhaps why, in our society, we see both those attitudes represented in an undue reverence towards science and the scientist, and at the same time, a high level of anti-intellectualism, deeply suspicious of scientific research. The Frankenstein image lives on. In what I want to say tonight, I hope to challenge both of those attitudes and do something to restore the idea that science is, after all, one of the things that human beings do. One of the things that human beings do. A set of practices which may exhibit values and morality, but which doesn't generate values and morality. A set of practices which finds its weight and its meaning in relationship to many other human practices. It was said by a famous scholar of cultural history that eros, sexual love, ceases to be a demon when you cease to regard it as a god. Something of the same nature might be said, I shall suggest, about science, that it ceases to be a demon when we cease to regard it as a god. But of course, the conflict between faith and science is a story deeply embedded in our corporate consciousness. We have most of us been brought up on the idea that science fights its way out of the intellectual clutches of religion to independence, non-accountability to religious doctrine. And we've also, most of us, been brought up on the story that in the 19th century in particular, that long-standing tension became harder than ever to bear and exploded particularly in relation to Darwin. In fact, the whole story is a good deal more nuanced than that. A number of historians of science have pointed out, with a great deal of supporting material, that most of the significant scientific advance in the 16th and 17th centuries came from ordained clergy of one church or another. And looking at the way in which the Darwinian controversy actually played out, you will have a much less clear black and white sense of an opposition between science and a religious establishment than you might at first suppose. I shall say just a word about that again later, but I do want at this stage to give notice that the picture is not as simple as many textbooks might lead you to believe. However, at the moment, we are facing certainly a resurgence of a sense of conflict between faith and science. Brilliant popularizers like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett have put the question on the agenda of most of us and on the bookstalls of the nation. What is the heart of the conflict as writers like these see it? Where is the tension felt to be most acute today? In tonight's reflections, I want to touch on two areas in which that conflict is assumed to be acute, and suggest some of the ways in which the religious believer might want to respond and take the conversation forward. First of all, then, the issue of what is sometimes now called neo-Darwinism. The heart of the conflict between faith and science, as it's frequently presented these days, is no longer a simple standoff between what people might regard as two rival accounts of how the world came to be. In spite of all the fuss about creation science versus evolution, that's actually not where the intellectual energy of the debate lies. The real issue is in the extension of Darwinian principle and theory beyond biology and genetics to become an entire theory of culture and intellectual life. This is a vision fairly regularly reiterated by Professor Dawkins and Professor Dennett, and it deserves a moment's explication. The theory, as it now appears, runs something like this. The most basic fact about the world of which we can be certain in scientific terms is that the way things are is the result of a process of natural selection. The almost unimaginably protracted weeding out of organisms that do not have a capacity to survive in a competitive environment. But if that is the most basic thing we know about the world we're in, surely that story ought to carry over into the story of our mental life and our culture. Culture itself is a set of strategies for survival. Ideas are about survival, and they compete in a marketplace not unlike that in which genetic selection occurs. This theory was given a particular form, partly by Richard Dawkins, partly by some of his followers, including Susan Blackmore, between 15 and 20 years ago in a theory of what's come to be called mimetics, on the analogy of genetics. A gene is the carrier of genetic information, enabling the replication of its structures and its survival. A meme, M-E-M-E, is a similar carrier of cultural information, securing replication from generation to generation. Just as you have, so to speak, nuggets of genetic information being passed on, so you have nuggets of cultural information being passed on. And so, if you want to understand the survival or the prevalence of cultural patterns and intellectual systems, you need to look at how they work as survival strategies. This can lead to recognition that, for example, just as in the genetic world you may have viruses that produce odd and unviable strains for a few generations, so you may have intellectual viruses as well that persuade you to believe silly things, religion being the prime example of such a virus in this system. Thus, natural selection comes to be the key which opens every lock in the human world. It becomes what Daniel Dennett has called a universal acid. It eats away facile confidence in systems that claim to be truthful. And it makes it, incidentally, but not accidentally, impossible to maintain that religious belief could have any objective value in a world where ideas are survival strategies. This, I think, is where the most interesting intellectual conflict now takes place. And these are issues that have been discussed by a number of writers and thinkers within the religious fold as well as outside. The questions have been raised from within the scientific establishment about this. Theologians and philosophers have also raised a number of significant issues. And selecting just 4 points from an increasingly unmanageable literature on this subject, these seem to be some of the unanswered questions in a system like the one I've just described. The first is actually itself a scientific problem. The problem usually designated by the word reductionism. That's the problem of how you decide what is the most basic form of explanation, and whether you think that the most basic form of explanation is the only real form of explanation. At what level do your questions work? And if you find there is another level at which you have to raise a different kind of question, does that mean that the questions you began with were unreal or insignificant? To put it concretely, what is the relationship between the questions a biologist might ask, the questions a chemist might ask, and the questions a physicist might ask? There are questions in biology for which sooner or later you're going to have to turn to chemistry. There are questions in chemistry for which sooner or later you're going to have to turn to physics. But does that mean that only physics asks real questions? So the process of reducing what seem to be real questions to a more basic level is, again, not as straightforward as it might seem. If you move to another level or another register, as you might say, of asking questions, does that mean that where you started is not real and that a complete account could be given of, let's say, biological issues in strictly physical terms? So there's a first question from within science itself. The system that I've called Neo-Darwinism is one which assumes fairly blithely that you can indeed reach a fundamental form of explanation, which is natural selection, applied across the board. But that is, in fact, to be committed to a style of argument which scientists themselves would regard as pretty problematic. Then there's the second and very obvious question related to that first one. How exactly do you move a successful explanatory model in genetics across into theories of culture? As the science or pseudoscience of mimetics has developed over the last couple of decades, there has been a great deal of confusion and indeed contradiction about what you might say by way of defining a meme, a unit of cultural information and reproduction. Are we talking about actual ideas, or are we talking about structures in the brain that carry and receive those ideas? What precise processes of reproduction are we talking about? Are they physically measurable? Are we not in danger of falling into what many philosophers of science call the fallacy of misplaced concreteness? That is, the assumption that when you've got a name for something, you've got a thing that wears that name round its neck. Even where genetics itself is concerned, the precise definition of a gene remains something that takes quite a lot of working out, and we must not suppose that a gene is a small object. The third issue is perhaps the most tricky and potentially corrosive here. It's the problem of self-refutation. If everything is a strategy for survival in the intellectual world, so is neo-Darwinism. If any intellectual system may be regarded as a virus within the system of replication, so may any scientific account of the world. There are, in fact, no criteria for establishing a neo-Darwinist view of the world as an ultimate or impregnable system which cannot be touched by the universal acid, as Dennett calls it, of this theory. What are the results of that for actual scientific practice and confidence in the scientific process? I quote here briefly from Connor Cunningham, a philosopher at Nottingham University, who writes, "If we do not resist the idea of Darwinism as a universal principle, biology literally eats itself, as it becomes like a racing driver who, to avoid friction, chooses tires that are so smooth they offer no resistance." In other words, a limitless extrapolation from genetics to a system for understanding all reality leaves scientific method itself stranded and without any grip on the real. And the fourth general consideration here, which would take rather longer than I have to spell out in adequate detail, is something to do with some of the philosophical confusions that can arise in such a theory as a result of supposing that when you have a basic mechanistic model, its terms and components have an obvious self-evident identity, labels round the necks once again, quite independent of the processes of scientific language and culture and transmission. The theory presupposes a view of knowledge as simply hanging labels round the necks of facts, which most philosophers would now regard as sadly outmoded and incoherent. So that perhaps is enough just to give notice of the fact that neo-Darwinism of the Dawkins and Dennett variety carries with it a rather substantial agenda of philosophical and conceptual difficulty. There may be versions of it which avoid one or more of those four very serious intellectual problems. But the point I want to make at this juncture is very simply that this kind of Darwinism is as vulnerable as any Christian theology is to the reproach of leaving behind the empirical method and looking for some sort of coherence with observable fact. The truth is that both neo-Darwinism and Christian theology are telling stories. They both work as narratives. Narratives assume drama, agency, personality. But the paradox is that one of these stories knows what it's doing and confesses that it is working in the categories of drama and agency and personality, and the other apparently doesn't. What's more, the neo-Darwinist grand narrative about natural selection subverts its own claims and denies its own character. And so one point I should want to make with some force at this stage is that if we are to have a dialogue, an intelligent dialogue, between faith and science, it should be on a basis of equal self-awareness. We can't have a sensible or constructive dialogue if one party is, so to speak, smuggling into the argument premises that are uncomfortably like those of the other without acknowledging them. When I'm in very mischievous mood, I'm tempted to think that neo-Darwinism and creationist science deserve each other. Creationist science is a particular variety of slightly questionable science pretending to defend theology. And I would be inclined to say that neo-Darwinism is a questionable theology pretending to be science. Both mistake the real category in which they work. But when faith and actual scientific practice meet, it should be clear, though alas it often isn't, that we're not dealing with a standoff between two rival explanations of the world at the same level. It's not that religious faith offers an explanation which could substitute for the work of science. Scientific research seeks to identify the causes of particular phenomena and clusters of phenomena, including, of course, that remarkable cluster of phenomena which is the observable universe as we now know it. Faith states, not as a matter of explanation, but as a matter of trust, that any form of energy whatsoever at any stage of the history of the universe depends upon the free initiative of God. You may or may not accept that as a belief, but the one thing it isn't is an attempt to supply local, limited explanations for this or that. And religious traditions at least pose the question to not only neo-Darwinism, but some other forms of scientific theory, pose the question of how, within the simplicities of the world of Professor Dawkins or Professor Dennett, it comes to be that some part of this system of selection issues in a self-aware, self-questioning, language-using being, such as we are. To ask the question is emphatically not to say, you can only explain that by invoking God. That's not how religious language works. But if natural selection of the Dawkins-Dennett variety, the neo-Darwinist variety, cannot manage the idea of a self-aware, self-questioning being emerging with any coherence, clearly science has more work to do than is simply covered by the simplicities of these theories. Survival strategies have apparently produced organisms and phenomena which require, for their life and their sustenance, a stance beyond survival, beyond mere strategy. Science itself arises out of asking questions that are not strictly necessary, just as art and faith arise. The very concern with exploring the coherence of the universe, over and above the mere needs of technology and manipulation, suggests that a narrowly neo-Darwinist structure will not do to account for this. There is more to us than we know. And science is a means not simply of arriving at closure and certainty, but also of generating further upsetting and disturbing questions. Science is gloriously and rightly unstable. We may think of it as providing final answers. The fact of the life of scientific communities suggests that the real energy in science is the constant generating of new problems. And that takes me on to a remark about scientific practice as such. Scientific practice, what scientists do, very often has about it an ethos, literally a morality, a set of assumptions about appropriate behavior. How do you relate to the phenomena that confront you? With attention, with, one can't avoid the word, humility. The scientific method has a very marked moral, even spiritual component. And that's one of the things which makes both popular scientism and anti-scientism inadequate. Within scientific practice, there is a subtle balance of security and insecurity, discovery and fresh questioning, which is, in fact, remarkably like the way in which human beings behave in their relationships with one another and the world at large. So far from science being a small, privileged area of absolute certainty in a wilderness of doubt and superstition, science, in practice, gets to look surprisingly like human activity. I'll take just one example where this is perhaps specially marked. You'll be aware of the enormous advances in the Human Genome Project in the last decade or so. The extraordinarily, exhilaratingly ambitious project of mapping the genetic components of humanity. This immense exercise has produced a fairly comprehensive map. How precisely that map relates to anything we see in human behavior remains obscure. I've been privileged to see in recent weeks a printout of a rather small percentage of the genome map, marked out in different colors. Dark pink for the things about which we're certain, lighter pink for the things about which we have a pretty good idea, and green for the things about which we have no idea whatsoever. What is intriguing is to see the relative proportions, that in a printout several yards long, some dozen lines may be marked in dark pink. And that, of course, is part of where the excitement, the exhilaration of such science comes from. As I've said, it feels remarkably like human thinking in other areas. Some things we know, and some things we don't. Some things, to use the great phraseology of Donald Rumsfeld, we know we don't know. And some things we don't know we don't know. What's more, we may have a very strong commitment to the mechanisms of cause and effect, and yet recognize that in the real world, no one cause produces one effect. And that is as true in the world of genomics as it is in the world of ordinary human observation. The causal process is real, but infinitely layered and interactive. The causal process is a nexus of relationships, not the billiard balls nudging one another of primitive science and primitive philosophy. Thus far, what I've been trying to say is to warn against both messianism around science, science as the solver of all our problems and the bringer of ultimate freedom, and Luddite suspicion and terror of science. What scientists do and what scientists discover is never evil from a religious point of view. The question of meaning and of use is thrown back upon us, the human observers of this particular human practice, who have to make sense out of it, individually and socially. And when the researcher has come up with an ambiguous, an uncertain, a potentially dangerous discovery, we are left with the task of evaluating, we individually and socially. And if we have a problem about the advance of scientific research, as so many seem to these days, we need to remember that the problem is not in research, but in the lack of a shared moral, philosophical, or even religious framework within which to make sense of what the scientist delivers. Let me add just one more observation on that. I've said that what the scientist discovers is never evil. The acts by which we make use of what may be discovered can be evil. And so, in certain contexts, can be scientific method when undisciplined by a shared moral framework. Once again, the scientist takes from society a sense of what is and isn't legitimate in relation to human beings. In the Third Reich, with its deeply anti-human philosophy, its racism and its assumption about the way in which some human communities existed solely for others to dominate them, in that context, it made sense for a scientist to assume that some living human beings were proper objects for research. And the research that was carried out in the death camps is one of the great blots on the history of the 20th century. But it's true, to take an even more difficult example, it's true that over the last century, our general social attitudes to the level of research that's regarded as permissible in respect of other living organisms, our attitudes have changed. We are more restrictive in our attitudes about animal-based research than we were, and that is much more tightly controlled than it would have been decades back. Which is also to say that some of the very neuralgic issues that are now around about the propriety, let's say, of deliberately creating human embryos for research purposes, These are not wholly new questions, nor are they questions that the scientist alone can settle. In all these instances, what the scientist is permitted to do by society depends on attitudes and practices that science itself has not generated and is not capable of generating. My point then is, moving into the second area, though I'll deal with it much more briefly, the second area of focus for this evening, my point is that the debate is not between religion and science as if we were talking about obscurantism versus intellectual freedom. We're talking about the variegated ways in which the method and the outcome of scientific research relates to other human practices. It relates to how organisms and individuals are seen or valued in other human practices. In a tyrannical and anti-human society, the scientist will be allowed experimentation on human subjects, and the issue of that research may be used to reinforce tyranny. The point, however, is that the scientist is not the one who has the problem here. It is the social order in which the scientist works. And when those practices of valuing organisms are confused in our wider society, when we lack some elements of clear definition about what counts as human, it's not surprising that the method and issue of scientific research becomes problematic. So, one of the paradoxes that emerges from all this is, I believe, that religious faith can and ought to support and encourage science. Science as a practice with an impressive morality and spirituality. A commendation of attention and humility, the setting aside of self, very frequently in the context of addressing the most painful vulnerabilities of the human world. A practice that trains selfless, even contemplative approaches to the world. The quarrel is not with that. The quarrel is with a culture confused about how it values different kinds of organism, whether you're talking about animal research or embryo research. The problem lies with our lack of clarity in that area. And I don't suggest for a moment that that is a difficulty we shall solve overnight, or even that there is any one overwhelming religious system which will answer all those questions straight away. I note simply, those are the issues that religious faith has an obligation to keep in the public sphere. More of that tomorrow. And there may also be a quarrel with a situation where science itself is in some sense corrupted, seduced into making exaggerated claims for its problem-solving possibilities. The recent work of John Gray of the London School of Economics has underlined some of the ways in which a new superstition about science can be sometimes colluded with by scientists understandably eager to establish their research profile and resource. To draw to a conclusion, I've been suggesting, first of all, that we need a great deal of clarification of our terms in understanding the encounter between faith and science. So often, this encounter has been a matter of shadow boxing. And so often in our contemporary setting, even at quite a sophisticated level, it can still be so. The theologian may find himself or herself fighting against a covert theology on the part of the scientist. the scientist may mistake what the believer is claiming for creation or providence. And a good deal of patience seems to be required to tease that out. But within all that, it seems to me quite important that we should recognize that popular neo-Darwinism, that form of scientific theory most problematic these days for religious belief, is itself deeply vulnerable to intellectual challenge, and is so partly because, precisely, it's trying to be a theology. But I've also been arguing that we take seriously science as a practice, something people do, that we look at what people do and in what moral and spiritual register they do it, and that we understand that the toughest problems around scientific research, the toughest moral problems, are not generated by scientists, but by the confusion around them. And we should not seek to answer those problems by some kind of almost unimaginable censorship of scientific research, but by better public debate about what human distinctiveness and human dignity might be. One of the many great men buried in this abbey is Charles Darwin. If you read the biographies, you'll discover that at Darwin's death, a number of his friends and associates were, so to speak, getting ready for a battle royal over where he should be buried. And it was a dog that didn't bark. The ecclesiastical establishment at the abbey and elsewhere welcomed Darwin's burial in their midst. Distinguished clergy preached obituary sermons about Darwin, underlining precisely what I've been saying about the ethos of the work, the spirit of attention, the spirit of selflessness. The Bishop of Gloucester preached a sermon in which he somewhat complacently observed that in no other country in Europe would a distinguished agnostic scientist be buried in a Christian place of worship. And whether or not he was right about that, it's a very significant witness to the fact that the standoff between faith and science, even between faith and Darwin, was not always what we might imagine it to be. And that attitude to Darwin, represented by his burial in this place, is perhaps a good model for seeing the centrality in our thinking about faith and science of practice. What do scientists do? They do one of the things that human beings do. The sense, the import, and the meaning of what they do are not internally generated, but generated by that complex web of thinking, imaging, and imagining that is society. And that in itself begins to lead us towards tomorrow's questions about those other things that human beings do, which we call politics, on which more tomorrow. Thank you.